Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from a woman who was skeptical of COVID-19 and the vaccine, but then she got sick. The pandemic has also meant contact tracers have kept busy, and sometimes those calls are not easy ones to make.
There's been a couple calls that I've made where the person actually was really, really anxious and just needed someone to, like, talk to them. And I think that sometimes we forget that this has been a very isolating thing for people, and it's affected people's mental health as well.
There's a new weather warning when it comes to severe thunderstorms. We'll explain that. Also, the Chicago area now has a climate action plan. What does that mean? We'll hear about it. And we'll talk with some postcard collectors. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, a lot of states are trying to find ways to control the feral hog population. We'll find out more on that. We'll also hear from a former vaccine skeptic who's changed her mind after she got COVID. And we'll tell you about a new weather warning you may start seeing on your phone alerts. That and more this hour on Statewide. Well, in 2020, the Illinois Department of Public Health awarded $300 million in grants to local health departments for contact tracing. Peter Medlin talked with several tracers who've been on the job talking to sick Illinoisans for nearly a year.
Julie Hovland has talked to more people infected with COVID-19 than just about anyone. She's been a contact tracer for the Winnebago County Health Department for the past 11 months. A former substitute teacher forced indoors by early lockdowns, she was glued to her TV watching daily COVID briefings from the governor and public health director. And when they announced Illinois would be hiring thousands of contact tracers to help slow the spread, she leapt at the chance. She says in November, when the pandemic was at its peak in Illinois and over 10,000 new daily cases rolled in, it was a bit overwhelming.
When volumes were really, really high, we weren't able to call everybody or have them answer as well, make contact with people.
Tracers sometimes worked 60 to 70 hours a week, fielding incoming calls while also trying to make contact to interview people and hopefully contain the spread of the virus.
In the very beginning, we often told people their test results because they didn't get them yet, because now it's more efficient of getting your results.
Those can be hard calls when people try in real time over the phone to unpack the implications of illness and how it affects them and their families. That's when contact tracers like Julie jump in with information both about the virus and the resources at their disposal if they need help. Their services include anything from income assistance and grocery delivery to, now, vaccine information. They also ask contacts to participate in text or email monitoring to keep up with their symptoms. Charity Bolden is another Winnebago County tracer who's been at it since last fall.
People need letters for their employers stating that they need to be out of work for a certain amount of time, so we help with that.
Both contact tracers say they can count on one hand the number of people who were openly hostile and didn't want to engage with them at all. And even though we're over a year into COVID-19, Bolden says many people they talk to don't know about the support programs they can offer.
You know, a lot of people I speak with don't know some of the information, especially in the Spanish-speaking communities, just because the resources might not be available to them written or spoken.
Sometimes there's still a lot of fear when they talk to people, and she says they're often the only phone call people get when they're sick.
There's been a couple calls that I've made where the person actually was really, really anxious and just needed someone to, like, talk to them. I mean, I think that sometimes we forget that this has been a very isolating thing for people, and it's affected people's mental health as well.
It's been a weight on the tracer's mental health too, but Bolden says getting to educate and share information that could save not only their clients' lives, but the lives of the people around them is enough to keep her going.
I make a phone call to one person that could connect me to potentially, depending on the situation, 20 more people who have families. It just all webs out.
Winnebago County's volume of calls is still far below last fall, but cases are creeping back up as, because of the new Delta variant, they rise statewide. The variant makes tracing more challenging, too, since it's more contagious and the time from exposure to infection is faster. Hovland says vaccines have also changed the most common ages of people they contact.
There's fewer people over 65 that we're interviewing.
Bolden agrees and says she's had many more young people in their 20s and 30s lately. And she says they're not usually scared and just want to know what they need to do. And whereas in the past, they'd talk to a lot of people who are asymptomatic and got tested as a precaution, Hovland says the people they talk to these days have usually known or strongly suspected they had the virus for some time. The pandemic isn't over, and neither is their mission, though conditions may have changed. Some Winnebago County tracers even work in person in an office now. But as the number of cases continue to go up, and with schools returning next month, it looks like they won't be out of a job anytime soon. I'm Peter Medlin.
Skepticism over the COVID vaccine is varied. Some is rooted in historical distrust of medical professionals. Others think the shots were developed too quickly, or they think they're healthy enough to avoid the negative effects of the disease. Tim Shelley talked with a Peoria area woman who was a skeptic until she and her family dealt with the virus themselves.
This time last year, Jessica Archdale thought the COVID-19 pandemic was overblown.
Even though I heard of patients maybe being sick around the area, I didn't know anybody that was sick. I thought it was all maybe Chicago area.
Self-proclaimed naysayer, Jessica believed COVID was more or less no worse than the usual flu bug. But last November, she began to sneeze. She chalked it up to allergies during an unusually warm late autumn. But when her mom called to tell her a family friend that she'd seen the past weekend and test positive for COVID, Jessica decided to get tested for herself. It came back positive.
I thought, even if I did get it, you know what, it's just going to be a cold. I am a healthy person besides obesity. It'll be just fine. But I was mistaken.
Jessica ended up in the hospital twice for breathing difficulties. In the meantime, her family friend died from his COVID complications.
I gave my husband account information and wrote letters to my family because I didn't think that I was going to make it. It was really scary, and I don't ever want to feel that way ever again.
Like many skeptics, Jessica originally had her doubts about the ongoing vaccine development efforts, too.
I was one of the ones that thought that the vaccine was maybe coming out quickly.
A concern about rush vaccines is a common reason heard for hesitancy by Dr. Mark Meeker, an internal medicine physician at OSF St. Mary Medical Center in Galesburg.
None of the steps were skipped in regards to looking for safety signals, but they were all expedited.
Meeker says the sped-up emergency authorization process was necessary to respond to the pandemic as quickly as possible. He says the challenges doctors like him face is helping people understand corners weren't cut in that process.
We've given nearly 100,000 vaccines within the OSF ministry. If there were major safety issues with this vaccine, we would be seeing the signal for 100,000 people vaccinated.
Another challenge is helping people understand why the medical guidance is shifting throughout the pandemic.
This was a virus that we hadn't seen before. So that created a lot of unknowns. And as we learn, we might change our position on something. That doesn't mean that we weren't being honest in the first place. It means that we're learning more as we go.
As for Jessica Archdale, her perspective on COVID-19 and the vaccine has shifted.
After I had what I had, I did not ever want to feel that way again. And so I did get the vaccine, and I'm happy that I did.
Her husband and two kids are also vaccinated after coming through their own struggles with COVID around Easter. She says she gave her kids a choice whether or not to get the vaccine. But for them, that was an easy decision.
They were very willing and excited because they want to go back to a normal life, as we all do.
Vaccination rates are slowing in the Tri-County area. Peoria City County Health Department Administrator Monica Hendrickson says it's important to celebrate incremental progress.
We're at the point in this campaign that every arm matters, and so we want to continue doing this work.
And Dr. Mark Meeker says while the situation is improving, it's not time to fully let your guard down.
So, you know, we're all hoping and praying that between natural immunity and the vaccine rates, that we're getting to where we can, you know, start to come out of this pandemic. But I wouldn't say that we're out of the woods by any means.
That's Tim Shelley with that report. We've all seen severe thunderstorm warnings, but not all storms are the same. And the National Weather Service next week begins a new way to classify and warn about storms with the potential to do the most damage. A new category, labeled destructive, will show on your phone alert when warranted. And I talk with Chris Miller, the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Lincoln, about that change.
It's a what we call a damage threat tag that goes at the end of severe thunderstorm warnings. And what would prompt this is if we were anticipating or getting reports from trained storm spotters of either 80 mile per hour or greater thunderstorm winds and or baseball-sized hail or larger. We're using the damage threat tags in tornado warnings. We use that for example, if we do a tornado emergency, we use either a considerable or what we call a catastrophic tag. And we also do the very same thing for flash flood warnings, depending on the depth of water, the widespread nature of the flooding, and that sort of thing.
Now, I get a lot of warnings on my phone, I guess like most people. Is this just a way for it to stand out, maybe grab people's attention a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to get people's attention with severe thunderstorms simply because, you know, we're already alerting people's cell phones for tornado threats, for flash flood threats based on, you know, weather-related things. But if we add severe thunderstorm to that, that's everything from hail, you know, 1 inch all the way up to, you know, 60 mile per hour or greater. So we've added these categories to the severe thunderstorm warning to delineate which ones we really want to bring to people's attention. And it's the destructive tag with the 80 mile per hour greater wind or the baseball-sized hail. That is what's going to alert your cell phone. And those don't really occur all that often. It's going to be a pretty rare thing to see that, particularly in the state of Illinois. You may only get that once a year, if that.
I think back to some storms and a term that probably many people didn't know until more recently, the term derecho, which came up in northern and also southern Illinois in recent storms. Very gusty winds, hurricane, I guess, strength winds in some cases. Is that what we're talking about here? Does it have to reach close to that level?
Yeah, it would need to reach close to that level because one thing to mention is that of the 22 costliest weather disasters in last year, 13 of them were from severe thunderstorms, and this is nationwide. One of those, the most recent one, was the August 10th derecho that affected Iowa, northern Illinois, and parts of northern Indiana. And that particular one would have activated this destructive damage threat on people's cell phones because we were getting wind gusts of 80 to well over 100 miles per hour with that storm. And that kind of wind is going to cause a lot of damage similar to many of the tornadoes we get around here. So we needed a way to get a widespread notification of people that could be impacted by this.
I think most people would probably think of tornadoes when they think of, you know, very serious storms. But like you mentioned, these thunderstorms, they do come through sometimes in a way that they are just as destructive. Do you find that people maybe don't take those quite as seriously?
Absolutely. We're definitely finding that because just hearing the word tornado, you envision this rotating storm that's going to cause all this extensive damage, which they do. But roughly two-thirds of the tornadoes we get in the state of Illinois have winds very similar to what we get from severe thunderstorms. And we need to alert people to the fact that severe thunderstorms, just because there's no rotation going on, can produce just as much, if not more, damage than many of the tornadoes we get.
And before we wrap up, I thought I might just like to hear your thoughts on the fact of technology, how it's improved through the years. I'm old enough to remember when the weather alerts were a lot less precise. And now Doppler radar, I see tornado warnings that are often issued that say it's a Doppler-indicated threat. So maybe nobody's actually seen this tornado with their own eyes, but you're able to spot that on the radar. And I'm guessing that helps for all these types of storms to give more warning to people.
Yeah, the key is to get warning out in enough time that people can take the proper protective actions. And a lot of times the storm is still in the development stage where it hasn't produced that type of wind, or it hasn't produced the large hail yet, or the tornado. And so the radar can detect when those things are about to happen, particularly at night. I mean, we rely heavily on storm spotters to give us, you know, what indication of what that storm is doing in real time. But at night, it's very difficult to see that. So the radar really produces a wonderful piece of information for us to make these decisions to help people decide whether or not they need to seek shelter from the storm.
And I know a lot of people, they sign up for weather alerts from different sources, maybe a media outlet. Explain the role of the National Weather Service when it comes to issuing these alerts.
Yeah, the alerts for tornado warnings, flash flood warnings, and then for these most destructive severe thunderstorm warnings, yeah, that's coming directly from us at the Weather Service. Literally seconds after we issue that warning, your phone is alerting you. We don't have our own app, and if people want more, you know, information for some of the less destructive severe thunderstorm warnings or winter weather products, that type of thing, then, you know, we encourage people to have, you know, multiple apps on their phone to be able to receive this kind of information as well. These wireless emergency alerts that you'll receive on your phone for this tornado and flash flood and now the destructive severe thunderstorms, that is going to be for the vast majority of cell phones, smartphones. The older style phones, I know there's still a few out there, the flip phones that are not considered smartphones technically, probably will not receive those messages. It's the software within the newer cell phones, and when I say newer, I'm saying within the last, you know, 5-6 years. If you have a cell phone older than that, you may not receive these. So if you want to get these, that's something you would need to talk to your cell provider about with a newer or upgraded phone.
That's Chris Miller, the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Lincoln. The new destructive damage threat for severe thunderstorms will now be part of notifications starting next week, so take it seriously if you see that and seek shelter. Just a reminder, you can find our weekly statewide podcast through the NPR One app. Stick around, we have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, collecting history through postcards. We'll hear from an Illinois couple. That's on the way. Knox College's new president feels he was prepared to hit the ground running when he began the job this month. Rich Egger talked with him about his first few weeks.
The college announced the hiring of Dr. Andy McGadney in mid-February. McGadney says he spent the following months talking to current and former Knox trustees, as well as some faculty members. He also met numerous times via Zoom with his predecessor, Dr. Teresa Amat, who stepped down at the end of June after 10 years as the college's president. And McGadney says he met with more members of the Knox community during his first days in office.
My role here is truly understanding the culture of the place, getting to know people. I think it's really important to develop relationships early on before someone starts coming in, making changes or throwing around ideas. Part of the listening that I'm doing is really to ensure that the things that I'm hearing, the things that I'm seeing, the things that the board had put forth in their own presidential prospectus are aligning. And then, you know, together we look forward to developing a strategy for the short and long-term growth of the institution.
One of the challenges facing private colleges and public institutions would be enrollment. What do you think you can do to attract students to Knox College?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rich. You know, enrollment, I think, are concerns for many colleges and universities, both public and private, and they will be for some time. I think we need to just ensure that we're driving the demand for a Knox education. I think articulating the power of a liberal arts education and what it can do for young minds is a story that has been told and needs to be told, but in bigger and better ways, and using different sources of media to do that.
You're coming into office as the pandemic continues. Has Knox made a decision in terms of in-person versus online for classes and whether on-campus folks need to be vaccinated?
Prior to my arrival, the college did announce that we were going to require students to be vaccinated upon their return to campus. We are looking forward to welcoming students and faculty back on campus in person for the fall. But at the same time, we are also working very diligently to develop a kind of return to campus plan that would include testing. And we're in the process of having our plan reviewed or will be reviewed by experts to make sure that we're doing the best that we can to ensure a safe environment for our community. We should be announcing more details on this in early August.
As you get to know the campus and the community, they're getting to know you too. What would you like folks to know about you personally?
Part of what I've been trying to do over these first few weeks is to show, people exactly who I am through my actions, and some of those things are that I'm accessible, that I'm very open and willing to hear their ideas.
Dr. Andy McGadney is the new president of Knox College. McGadney says his mother taught first grade in Connecticut. He says through that, he learned about the power of education and how it can change a person's life. McGadney came to Knox from Colby College in Maine, where he was vice president and dean of student advancement. Rich Ugger reporting.
A new study from the University of Chicago explores the challenges doctors face when trying to get paid for healthcare services. The study focuses on Medicaid, the federal state program that provides health coverage for low-income and disabled people. The researchers find burdensome paperwork and payment denials cause many doctors to choose not to see Medicaid patients, and that increases disparities in healthcare access. To learn more, Christine Herman talked with Josh Gottlieb. He's an associate professor at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy.
Can you talk about the significance of losing access to care for people enrolled in Medicaid? What does that mean for the social safety net?
When we're providing our safety net through programs like Medicaid, which provide in-kind services as opposed to pure cash, the value of that to the recipients depends on what services they can get under that program. So it's a safety net. We set it up. And if you have trouble using it, then it's going to be lower value to the recipients. So if you're thinking about the comprehensiveness and the quality of the safety net, it's something you should take into account. So there's some really interesting research that other people have done that looks at the value of Medicaid to recipients, to beneficiaries. And I think what we're uncovering is only part of the explanation for why these other researchers have estimated pretty low values, right? Because if you have a program and it's supposed to get you healthcare, but it's hard to actually get that healthcare, that's going to lower the value compared with the alternative of getting uncompensated care and just not worrying about who's in network.
I don't know if there might be some people who might say, well, doctors should just take Medicaid. It's the right thing to do to create a social safety net. I've talked to enough patients who are enrolled in Medicaid who have stories about how frustrating it can be to access care. And maybe some of these administrative burdens are there to prevent fraud and unnecessary healthcare spending. And I'd be curious to hear, what's your take on that?
It's absolutely true that there may be justifications for these burdens. If you had no controls and you just paid any bill that any doctor or anyone claiming to be a doctor sent you, you'd be subject to all sorts of fraud and all sorts of misuse. And we know that overuse and misuse of care is a real problem in the healthcare system. So you absolutely need controls. The question is, are we doing a good job of balancing those controls against what we've demonstrated now to be a real serious consequence of them? Now, we're not able to answer that. I can't tell you, based on this study, how much, if any, fraud or misuse is deterred by these controls. I think that absolutely should be investigated. Some paperwork is useful. We've all dealt with paperwork that seems totally useless. There's probably some combination of each, and I really don't know which of those is what's varying at the margin here. You'd need to answer that question before figuring out if there's a real problem here or if this is totally justified. As for what this means for the broader access question and doctors' obligations, I think economists tend to think that if the government wants to provide a subsidy, it should do that directly rather than trying to force someone else to provide it, basically to keep things off of the books. It's most direct to provide a subsidy explicitly and directly. And if the subsidy is going to be a more generous health insurance plan, then the government should pay for it rather than trying to hide payments by, say, forcing doctors to accept Medicaid if they don't want to, if that's the alternative policy that you're suggesting. You know, it's up to the public, it's up to the legislatures, it's up to the bureaucracy, how generous, how effective they want Medicaid to be. All that we're saying here is that there are real trade-offs.
That's Josh Gottlieb, an economist at the University of Chicago, speaking with Christine Herman. Americans have responded to drug addiction in a number of different ways in recent decades. The war on drugs of the 1980s and 90s spawned mass incarceration of Black and brown populations. Some addicts, many of whom have some measure of wealth and privilege, are sent to rehab. In the face of the opioid crisis of the last decade, there's been a growing recognition of the inevitability of drug use. That attitude change has led to the proliferation of clean needle exchange centers in providing overdose medication, like naloxone, to drug users, their families, and law enforcement. In Illinois, one state lawmaker wants to provide a legal path for another approach, allowing people addicted to drugs to take illegal substances under the supervision of a medical professional. Derek Cantu has details.
Democratic State Representative LaShawn Ford of Chicago says supervised injection facilities, which he calls safe consumption rooms, would reduce the likelihood of fatal overdoses.
We know that not meeting people where they're at to provide the support that they need in the struggle of a substance use disorder only harms the community with loose needles, only harms families with preventable drug overdoses.
Currently, such facilities are illegal in the United States. At least 7 states and a few cities in the U.S. have tried to pilot legal injection site programs, but have mostly failed in the face of pressure from the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration and U.S. Justice Department. In all of those cases, the idea that users would bring their own drugs is a huge legal sticking point. In Philadelphia, a nonprofit called Safe House has been locked in a legal battle with the feds over its proposed injection site. Federal prosecutors there claim Safe House's project would violate the so-called crack house statute within federal drug law, which makes it a felony to operate a space dedicated to the manufacturing, distribution, or use of illegal drugs. Robert Bell, special agent in charge of the DEA Chicago Field Division, couldn't speak specifically to the Safe House case, but says the whole concept of a legal injection site does more harm than good.
When users purchase heroin and fentanyl, those transactions stimulate the illegal drug market by putting money in the hands of profit-driven drug organizations and even violent gangs.
Bell says instead of normalizing intravenous drug use, the DEA recommends drug counseling by medical professionals and occasional doctor-prescribed medicated-assisted treatments. But Rhonda Goldfein, the executive director of Safe House, says her organization is not encouraging drug use. Rather, Safe House would be providing an alternative approach to addiction. Drug overdose rates in Philadelphia are one of the highest in the country.
Safe House is composed of people of faith and conscience. We believe that if you can save a life, you're required to save a life.
North of the border in Canada, North America's first legal injection site fought for years to get exempted from that country's federal drug laws in order to operate. That was nearly 20 years ago. And now, Dr. Mark Lesician, Deputy Chief Medical Officer at Insight in Vancouver, says his organization sparked a movement that's extended to 25 other facilities across Canada. Lesician says Canadian centers like Insight also provide a number of wraparound services for patients, including access to counseling, test strips to determine whether drugs contain fentanyl, and clean needle exchanges.
We have, you know, we typically around 100 injections there a day, and, you know, since its opening, there's never been a death due to an overdose.
Representative Ford's proposal also calls for funding of other resources and services at safe consumption sites, including condoms, naloxone, educational literature, and drug rehabilitation counseling.
We know that in neighborhoods where overdoses are very prevalent, that resources are very low to help people with substance use disorder. This will be one that speaks to them directly.
I'm Derek Cantu.
Representative Ford's legislation stalled at the State House this spring, but is likely to get consideration again in the future. Charles and LaDonna Bobbitt may be Peoria's most prolific postcard collectors. The Bobbitts have even published a book featuring some of their favorites. Steve Tarter of WCBU spoke with the couple about their collection and the future of postcards in the modern day.
Well, I arrived here in 1981.
From?
Memphis.
Okay.
And I discovered that there's no histories. And it bothered me because the histories were something like 40 years old. And all of a sudden, I was at a flea market, and I saw my first Peoria postcard. It was the Bradley campus. And I thought, how that campus has changed. Well, that's where it started. I had one, then I got five, then I got 20, then I got 30, then I got 50, then I got 100. I think I have about 1,200 now. And
you got them in different – how do you categorize them?
For instance, Bradley, Caterpillar, Downtown – bridges, parks, hospitals, and the fun cards. That's what my wife likes, the fun cards.
Is that true, LaDonna? You like the fun cards? And what describe what a fun card is, because people maybe don't know that.
Well, she forced me to put a whole chapter in one of my books for her fun cards. There are cards that would say, "We're spending the night in Peoria, Illinois, and wish you were here." Or, "It's a sunny day in Peoria, Illinois." Or, "We're down at the river at Peoria, Illinois. Wish you could see it from here."
And they'll often have like a cartoon-type drawing
always,
on it.
Always. Yeah. And they're really collectible and they're really nice, but I didn't want to put in a book, but I was outvoted.
Now, do you get postcards today from anybody?
Very few. I've got them all.
But, I mean, no one's sending you postcards that you're aware of. I mean, they know you collect
them. Well, I get people will send me postcards.
But they're old postcards.
That they want to sell to me. And usually I say I'm not buying anymore because I have so many of them that, unless it's something really rare or unusual, and I'll tell you what's very collectible right now, is the old Block and Cool building, which people, you know of today as the Jefferson Bank building, and shortly it will be the OSF World Headquarters. And that particular building, they're getting a lot of pictures of it, and they're gonna do that well when they have the grand opening, I hope.
And that's just one more landmark in Peoria that you have from the postcards. What do you think is going to happen with the postcards that you have? I mean, is there a plan for you? I mean, are you going to do another book or what's the?
Well, the publisher wants another book, but probably not because things have changed. It used to be where I simply did the narrative, gave them the postcards, and they produced it. Now they want you to do it page proof. I thought, I'm not going to all that trouble.
Now, what about postcards today? The ones that, people are familiar with, they're usually glossy, nice, you go on vacation, you send a postcard. Do you see those making a comeback, or it's going to go to 40 cents now? I mean, can that compete with the internet?
Well, you got to remember that when people go places, they like to bring a souvenir back with them. And sometimes they don't want to spend much money, so they get a postcard. Hopefully they take it home with them, keep it, and in 50 years, somebody will find it in the attic and send it back to where it came from.
And that's a point you made because you were saying how the collection of postcards has changed thanks to sites like eBay. Because you mentioned you got your first postcard at a flea market, but now you look online, or a collector
true.
Would.
Well, for instance, a postcard mailed in 1903 to Boston, Massachusetts. I just picked the city out. The lady got it, or a gentleman got it, put it in his attic, forgot about it. 50 years later, when I cleaned the attic out, they found these postcards. This is hypothetical. And then they would put it on eBay. That postcard came back home to Peoria or Memphis or Nashville, wherever it came from. There's a lot of that going on now.
That's postcard collectors Charles and LaDonna Bobbitt of Peoria. And they spoke with Steve Tarter. There's more ahead on Statewide. Coming up, we'll hear how some states are trying to control the feral hog population. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Across the country, feral hogs are causing big problems. It's estimated they cause more than $2.5 billion in damages each year when they root up land and crops. And the wild pig population continues to grow. While some states encourage hunting, others have come up with a surprising way to try to control the population. Seth Bodine from Harvest Public Media has this report.
It's estimated that there are more than 6 million feral hogs across the country, and they can be huge, weighing up to 200 pounds, about the same as a Great Dane. The damage they cause can be extensive.
It's a menace. I don't do nothing but tear up your property.
That's Dylan Schoonover, a hunting guide at Hog Wild Preserve in Purcell, Oklahoma. Oklahoma is one of the states that still encourages hunting to help control the population. On a rainy day, Schoonover is leading Todd Kissinger on a hunt. After zigzagging through the woods for more than an hour, they see a group of hogs, and he starts to make oinking noises to lure them closer.
I told you there's a bunch of pigs in here. Yeah.
Kissinger came here from Kansas just for this hunt. As a farmer and rancher in Mulvane, Kansas, he understands how damaging some wildlife can be.
We have huge flocks of geese that come in our wheat fields, and they will mow it down. I mean, they will just eat it down to the bare dirt. So I can only imagine what a bunch of hogs will do when that's what their deal is to do 24/7, is to eat, root, and tear up.
But allowing hunting can be a double-edged sword. Dale Nolte heads the USDA's Feral Swine Program. One of the problems is that people bring in hogs to make it easier to hunt.
One of the big struggles we have is this, what seems to be a constant release of animals back into areas where they've been removed or into new areas.
Nolte says he has no problem with someone shooting a feral hog, but when they're released to encourage hunting, those hogs can destroy a lot of land. They could also be a health risk.
Feral swine carry a number of zoonotic diseases, which are detrimental to humans. I mean, swine brucellosis, hepatitis. We're finding leptospirosis in about 50 to 60% of the feral swine in some areas. There's a definite hazard out there.
Instead of hunting, the USDA is luring the hogs into big traps or shooting them from helicopters, both of which the department considers better options. In the Midwest, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska already have a range of restrictions on hunting feral hogs. Sam Wilson with the Nebraska Game and Parks Commission says when you allow hunting, it's actually harder to control the population.
The law seems counterintuitive at first because we're prohibiting people from hunting feral hogs. However, if you know anything about hunting and hunting culture, often the people who hunt deer, for instance, are interested in having good deer populations.
The 2018 Farm Bill created funds for wildlife services to address hog problem areas. And the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation started restricting hunting in those areas. But Eric Cohen, who works for the Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service in Oklahoma, says he runs into roadblocks trying to trap hogs on private land.
We've got to have their permission, and there's a lot of people that won't give us the permission to work on their property.
While states with growing wild hog populations are adding more restrictions, others like Texas and Oklahoma are still embracing the hunting of feral hogs. And hunting guides like Schoonover insist they're helping control the hogs.
You know, just like a manager of a company manages the company, and employees are employees. We manage populations, you know, and in turn, we get to eat awesome, awesome meat.
But guys like Schoonover might have a hard time finding a place to hunt as more and more states embrace hunting bans as a way to control populations. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
Trees' roles in agriculture tend to be viewed as limited to the lumber industry or highly organized orchards to grow fruits. But Jonathan All reports some farmers are looking to the forest floor to get more people into agriculture, at least part-time.
Dennis Lindbergh's 5 acres in southern Missouri don't look like a farm. After making our way past a fence and through a thicket of sticker bushes, We're in a heavily forested area on sloping ground. All around the forest floor are smatterings of small green plants. They're intentional. Those are the crops.
Now, here's some ginseng here that I planted, and I'm taking the seed from it and just planting it right down in here so it'll spread. But you got to get the seed in the ground.
Lindbergh grows ginseng, golden seal, and other plants that prosper in the shade. They're used in cooking, medicines, and supplements. He's one of a growing number of people who are doing very small-scale farming in forested areas to serve niche markets. Lindbergh says it's possible to make a decent living this way.
You grow 100 pounds of ginseng root out in the woods at $500-$600 a pound, well, that's pretty good money.
It's not quite that easy, though, because ginseng needs 7 years to grow before harvest, and it's worth more if you wait longer. Lindbergh has been forest farming for almost 40 years, and much of that time he's had another job raising hogs. Forest farming advocates say it's an underutilized form of agriculture. Hannah Hemmelgarn is with the University of Missouri Center for Agroforestry. She says the key is to find the right crops to plant in the right kind of forest.
And I think there are ways that people who are doing this are getting really creative and creating markets and creating interest in these value-added products especially.
Forest farmers are also finding markets for products including black walnuts, witch hazel, and ramps. The Helmuth family owns Ozark Forest Mushrooms in Missouri. They grow a special variety of shiitake mushrooms on white oak logs. Instead of building shade shelters, they grow them under a stand of yellow pine trees on their land about 150 miles southwest of St. Louis. Stacks of logs under special blankets are covered with mushrooms waiting to be picked. Henry Helmuth says these mushrooms are analogous to heirloom tomatoes.
These have a stronger flavor, are more unique, and it's also just a different variety, so you'll see the ones in the store look slightly different. They've got just a subtly different flavor.
Henry Helmuth is the son of the founders of the farm. They harvest between 100 and 500 pounds of mushrooms a week all year round and drive them to St. Louis, where they're sold for $10 a pound wholesale to restaurants and specialty grocery stores and a couple bucks more at farmers markets. He says this farm is profitable in part because they also have a B&B that is booked months in advance and includes a mushroom tour with a stay.
Not to be too pessimistic, but there's many easier ways to make a living. Just any small-scale farming operation, you're going to realize it's not that profitable an endeavor. It's a hard endeavor, 7 days a week, always working. But also, a lot of people love that lifestyle, you know, feeling connected to your work directly.
And that draw to farm and work with the land may get more people into forest farming, partially because the cost to get into the business is much lower than conventional farming. Hemmelgarn says a few acres and some basic supplies costs far less than hundreds of acres and the high-tech machinery needed to grow row crops like corn or wheat.
Keeping trees in the ground, planting trees, and thinking about ways to integrate our livelihoods with tree landscapes and making a livelihood or a part of your livelihood from those spaces, I hope is going to be more part of the agricultural landscape moving forward.
She says another part of the allure to forest farming is the desire to mitigate climate change. More trees means less carbon in the atmosphere. The U.S. Department of Agriculture identifies forest farming as a good alternative to supplement income for farmers and other landowners, but stops short of calling it a full-time occupation. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Well, after nearly 2 years of work, the Chicago region is now among the few areas of the country to have a sweeping plan to deal with climate change. It includes lofty goals, such as reducing driving and cutting carbon emissions over the next 3 decades. Promoters say work needs to be done now to help the area stave off the effects of the warming planet. From member station WBEZ, Michael Puente has this report.
There's an old saying in Chicago, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute. The Chicago area has certainly seen extremes in weather in recent years. Super deep freezes, heavy storms causing flooding and lake erosion, drought, and huge lake effect snow events this past winter. Is it all a fluke? Not to climate scientists like Richard Spinrad, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Even though we're in the middle of the warmest summer on record, in the United States, let's not lose sight of the extreme conditions the Chicago region faces during winter. As the Great Lakes warm, they can fuel more intense lake effect snowstorms.
Spinrad says while extreme heat is felt on the West Coast and hurricanes are on the East these days, it's Chicago sitting in the Midwest that may be most vulnerable to a warming planet.
Heat is the leading cause of weather-related deaths in the U.S. The Chicago region is warming faster than the globe as a whole.
To do something about this, government leaders from more than 200 communities in the Chicago area, with help from NOAA, have devised a plan, an action plan. The 124-page Chicago Region Climate Action Plan details the small to grand ideas communities can do to mitigate the effects of climate change. Here's Geneva, Illinois Mayor Kevin Burns, chairman of the committee for the 275-member Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus that put the plan together.
If we all do something together, the impacts, positive impacts, are better.
Burns says the plan is intended to be a roadmap.
First and foremost, the plan is not a fiat. It's a framework of collective action to reach a collective goal. And we believe we can do that by acting in a regional way.
The plan, rolled out earlier this month, lists six high-priority climate hazards that can potentially impact people's health, including extreme heat, flooding, drought, and air quality. To combat this, planners want to find better ways to heat our homes, manufacture products, deal with waste, and get from point A to point B. All this to reduce CO2 emissions by 80% by 2050.
So we've got to get off dirty electricity, right? The grid has to get cleaner and we need more renewable energy.
Edith Macra is Director of Environmental Initiatives for the Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus and one of the two lead authors of the action plan. She says revising municipal codes to allow solar power to become more attractive for residents and business owners could help the area reach its emissions reduction goal.
Untangling processes for permitting, inspection, and cleaning up zoning codes so that solar has a glide path, that there aren't bureaucratic barriers that are completely unnecessary and not helpful to anyone.
Another priority is transportation, which accounts for nearly 30% of CO2 emissions that contribute to global warming.
And so we already have in mind a proposal on the beginning of a similar process for electric vehicle charging infrastructure.
The action plan acknowledges that communities of color often feel the effects of climate change most heavily, since many Black and Latino communities live close to factories that emit CO2. We've seen protests in places like Chicago's Southeast Side over the relocation of a car shredding facility. Similar battles are fought outside the city in places like North Suburban Waukegan, where more than half of the city's 90,000 residents are Latino. Maya Dutta, sustainability coordinator for Waukegan, says communities of color have to feel that they can benefit from this action plan.
So industry in Waukegan, past and present, has polluted our air, water, land, and has disproportionately affected the health of our community members and critical ecosystems. These are major challenges in the way of climate action, and it's unacceptable. So climate action should be directly improving the resident quality of life.
Dutta says these are challenges for Waukegan and communities like it to acknowledge what has happened, but also do something about it. For example, Waukegan is expecting a retirement date next year for a coal-fired power plant, a huge contributor to CO2 emissions, which is close to nearby residents.
It's very important for all communities, especially a community like Waukegan, which is an environmental justice community. So this is a really good way to train people to always be thinking about the environmental justice implications when we're enacting a policy or strategy.
The Climate Action Plan should also be seen as a guide to building a new economy, while also preparing for what can come years from now, says Ned Gardner, engagement officer with NOAA, who co-wrote the report with Edith Macra.
Choices that we make today that impact our preparedness and ability to deal with extreme events tomorrow. And if we don't do that, we know what the outcomes are. Chicago has lived through major heat waves that have killed hundreds of people. It's not something we want to repeat.
The framers behind the Climate Action Plan are working to ensure the document doesn't collect dust. They plan to meet with residents and community groups to educate the public on the specifics of the report. I'm Michael Puente.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week Statewide. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Statewide episodes are available at statewideshow.com and through the NPR One app. Also, remember to like us on Facebook. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.